a little something to think about while you may be digging out. Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principled Policy. And along with me today is our co-host, the Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst and very good friend, Chuck Michaelis.
Good to be back with you on this cold Thursday. Yes, that's right. We pre-record these. These aren't live. And it's cold today, and we're expecting, you called it Snowmageddon today in our interview with Mike at WLRY. And I think I called it the Screaming White Death.
If you're listening to us here today on Saturday, the day that this broadcast airs, you may be digging out from what could be the largest snowstorm, at least of 2016. So,
yeah,
forecasting right now is calling for, I know in my area, in your area, Chuck, you may be a 3 to 5 inch at most, maybe even as low as an inch, or maybe even just a dusting, depending on how this weather front tracks. My area, they went from yesterday saying 12 to 16 inches of snow back down to 6 to 12 inches of snow as of this morning's forecast. And by the time that snow actually starts arriving sometime on Friday, we could end up with as much as 2 feet of snow or as little as an inch or so.
Well, we need to pray for folks on the East Coast who essentially are going to get what they call a nor'easter.
Yeah, absolutely. It is going to be brutal along the East Coast from Virginia up into the Baltimore, Washington, D.C. area, on up into the Boston area.
We get the remnants of those here, but we don't get anything like what they get there when they get those nor'easters. They're just deadly.
Right. Now, I think that's interesting, Charles, because this week is also, there are a couple of milestone points here. One of them is very minor. We're actually, as we record this, and we're looking at this week, Wednesday would mark exactly a year before we swear in a new president. So the countdown is on, ladies and gentlemen, less than 365 days left of the Barack Obama administration. So that should warm a number of hearts out there, Charles. However, those warming trends may be like this snow. It may be colder than predicted, depending upon who the American electorate decides to pick as we move through the 2016 primaries and the 2016 general election. Right now, the precipitation of this is looking like snowing Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton at the moment, although Bernie Sanders and Ted Cruz would both have something to say about that.
Well, that's right.
We're going to look at some of that in a little bit more depth here later on in this morning's program. But right now, though, Chuck, the other thing is that this week is also the observance of the anniversary of the United States Supreme Court's opinion in a case called Roe versus Wade. Now, everybody's familiar with what that case is. That's the case that supposedly legalized, and I'm using the air finger quotes to say around the word legalized, the practice of abortion across America. However, Chuck, as constitutionalists, as the people who've studied the document and understand it, we understand that we have a justice and a legal system that are so far afield of the true definitions and true understandings of law and government that we've been fed the misconception that an opinion of a plurality or a simple majority of black robe oligarchs sitting on the Supreme Court actually creates law, which it does not do and has never been the case. It never have supposed to have been creating law. The courts do not make law. The Congress does. The courts only interpret laws that are made as to whether or not they have legitimacy and proper authority to be made by that particular level of government under our Constitution. And Roe v. Wade meets none of those. The big problem that we've had, Chuck, and I'll let you talk about this more because you're much more of an expert on this than I am, is the whole idea of judicial review and what the expansion to the states of restrictions that were only supposed to be to the Congress or to the federal branch of government in the Bill of Rights.
Well, first of all, I'm going to rebuke you. I'm not an expert.
Okay, I take that back. You're a well-traveled student.
Yes. People, you know, I've had requests. Will you come and be our expert? No, I will not. I will come and be a teacher and a student, which is what I am. An expert is somebody who knows every aspect of something inside and out and can answer any question. Guess what? I'm not there. Now, this whole judicial review thing is very interesting because it is a usurped power. And usurpation means that it's a power that's been assumed rather than actually vested. And that's an important word as well, that vestment, because all power actually lies with the individual. And that's the whole reason behind we the people of the United States in order to form a more perfect union. Basically, the states and the people, that's why the 10th Amendment says all powers not delegated to the federal government are retained by the states and the people respectively. Well, that's because the people have delegated to the state a certain set of powers, and those states then turned around and delegated some of those powers on the federal government, a very limited set. One of the powers that was not delegated to the federal government was the idea that the federal courts would act as an unelected umpire or referee and decide that some of the laws that the duly appointed representatives in Congress had passed and signed by a president could be found unconstitutional. Now, what did they have the power to do? Well, they had the power through their part of the enforcement arm to say on an individual basis, that law doesn't fit in this category, that particular law. And they could, as far as a court goes, could just fail to apply it so many times that the Congress looks at it and throws up its hands and says, yeah, they're right, this law is wrong. But what power has never been given is the idea that the courts can negate any law. And especially at the federal level, the state's laws have never been under the jurisdiction of the federal government, except in the case of the enumerated powers, because that's what the Supremacy Clause is all about. And if you don't understand what I mean, Article 6, where it basically says that laws passed in pursuance to the Constitution by the federal government have supremacy over the state laws. Well, that's only in the enumerated powers. That doesn't mean if the federal government usurps a power and passes a law taking away powers that are reserved to the states or the people, that it suddenly has supremacy, which is the argument you will see in most quote-unquote scholarship. And by the way, I don't want to be called a scholar either, because it's been my experience that scholar is simply a substitute word for expert. So I don't want to be one of those either. No, I'm a student, not a scholar. And just ask some of my teachers if they're still alive, some of my high school teachers. You can also ask some of my college professors. I'm definitely a student, not a scholar. But that being said, this has been a problem in our republic since as far back as 1803, Marbury versus Madison.
Yes.
This is the place where John Marshall, who was a noted nationalist, in other words, he wanted the federal government to have supreme authority over the states. He actually was one of the people that wanted to eliminate the states in favor of a national government. He came out and seized the power to review federal law. Well, nowhere in the Constitution is that given. And from there, Marshall is responsible for a great deal of the mischief that has gone on in our country since 1803. And by that, I mean, he would negate state laws that were clearly within the state's jurisdiction. He did a number of those things, especially as regards national banking. There were a number of cases that where states basically said, the national bank, frankly, doesn't count here. Ohio, it was a big player in that early on, wherein some nonsense was going on with the national bank branch here, I believe in Columbus, and the state passed a tax to basically force the national bank out. And it was a large tax for the time. I think it was $50,000. And of course, the bank refused to pay. So the state legislature sent out marshals who went into the bank, went into the vault, and seized the tax. So John Marshall basically came out and said, well, the power to tax is the power to destroy. That's where that phrase comes from. I'm sure you've all heard that. The power to tax is the power to destroy. That comes from a Supreme Court decision written by John Marshall, in which he was talking about the power of the states to destroy the national bank. So we have a long history of usurpation of power, and it is often done through the courts because the courts are not elected. They are, of course, are appointed during periods of quote-unquote good behavior.
Right.
That has been construed as being a lifetime appointment because, after all, what can a judge do that isn't good behavior?
Oh, let me go down the list.
Oh, I know. You and I both know that, Barry, but you know what the point is here. Basically, as long as he doesn't get caught robbing a bank, he virtually can't be removed from office. And there have been so few impeachments of federal judges. There have been a few. My mother's congressman is a man named Al C. Hastings, whose name pops up from time to time for some kind of liberal shenanigans. Well, he was a convicted and removed federal judge. He was convicted by the Senate in a trial for impeachment for misconduct on the bench. So basically people in South Florida were so cognizant of what was going on that they elected him to Congress. So
maybe they figured that if he was getting some for himself, he could get some for them too.
Well, unfortunately, in her district, that is probably the case.
Well, you know, Chuck, that kind of really also leads us into another piece there that we're going to talk about, and that is the fact that we have in this society in America, we've misunderstood definitions. I'll just put it that way. And you and I talk about this on the program that, you know, when people use the term conservative, they really don't understand what they're saying, or they use it in such a way with modifiers and adjectives to couch it or limit it to certain things or to do it in a way that people will think they're saying one thing when they're actually saying something else. And I think that we see that, you know, you talked about, you know, people voting for somebody because they really just didn't understand. I think we're seeing that here, and I think that's a concern with our current nominating process and the rise of Donald Trump, so to speak. And I've been hearing, you know, different pundits and even different politicians and candidates saying, you know, you've got all this information out here about Donald Trump that he's not conservative, that he is basically a liberal. He's given to Democrats, and he's been tight with, you know, the Clintons and given lots of money to the Clinton Foundation, that he's not a conservative.
Well,
but yet here he is out here leading in polls and potentially poised here in about a week or so to win the New Hampshire vote. Probably won't win the Iowa caucuses, but he'll probably win the New Hampshire primaries because the numbers just have been consistently in the high 30s to low 40s in New Hampshire for Donald Trump. And it has given rise, and this week, a fairly noted conservative, and I use that term conservative, it's a loaded term, radio commentator came out decrying this whole idea that conservatism may be dead, or at least in its waning days, and that it's being overtaken by the concepts of nationalism and populism. And of course, that commentator is Rush Limbaugh. And Chuck, you know, I really think that, you know, we can throw those terms out there to a lot of folks. You know, conservatism, I think, like I said, if you put adjectives in front of it, or even if you don't, a lot of people have varying definitions of what conservative really means. I mean, some people will call, you know, and I'll use our favorite whipping boy, John Kasich, a conservative. I don't think he is. People are calling Trump conservative. I'm pretty sure he's not. You have fiscal conservatism, compassionate conservatism, common sense conservatism, social conservatism. You have all of these various flavors of conservatism, but again, it's the question of what do we mean by it? And then when Limbaugh comes out here and talks about these whole ideas that the concepts of nationalism and populism are overtaking conservatism, it begs the question for me, is it really the fact that yes, we know by definition, in a technical and a philosophical sense, those three terms are not interchangeable with each other. They each have specific fixed ideas of what that is. However, my thought and concern is, in the general public, voting public, that is, people who have nationalistic tendencies or people who have populistic tendencies have, well, without actually putting the adjective in front of it, modified what conservatism means to fit what they believe, which is one of those other two philosophies, nationalism or populism.
We need to talk about this idea about what nationalism is. Okay, and nationalism can wear the guise of conservatism, but it's not. Nationalism is an idea, and it's closely tied, by the way, to populism. Nationalism is the idea that the interests of a specific nation are absolutely paramount, not only to the interests of that nation, but to the interests of the world. So in other words, it is, if you would, it's a perversion of something like, you know, we've talked from time to time about American exceptionalism. And there's kind of a good way to view American exceptionalism and a really bad way to view American exceptionalism. The good way is that people wanted to be different. They wanted to create the shining city on a hill to be an example to others. Bad American exceptionalism is nationalistic in that it's like, we are American, we're the best, we're the most powerful, that we can do no wrong in the world. Well, okay, some people have accused patriots of being nationalists. Well, sometimes patriots, again, can be disguised as nationalists, or nationalists can be described as patriots. But a patriot says they want their country to do the right thing and be the best they can be. And again, it goes back to that American exceptionalism idea, to be that shining city on a hill and be an example to the rest of the world about how to do things the right way. So now that I've completely confused the issue.
No. That's fine, because, you know, what I'm saying is that there are people who are nationalistic or populistic, but they are calling themselves conservatives.
Yes, exactly.
And we see that too, because, you know, honestly, there are a lot of libertarians who would, you know, if just asked, are you conservative or not, they would say, yeah, I'm pretty conservative. But they're conservative libertarians.
That's right.
Or they're conservative independents, or they're conservative nationalists. They're tying that in. So when we see here, especially in the electorate, you know, this move toward Donald Trump, I think that's what is bothering Rush Limbaugh, is Donald Trump, and I've said this numerous times on this program, Chuck, Donald Trump is a populist.
Oh, absolutely.
He is figuring out what hot buttons to push with the electoral base, and he's pushing them as hard as he can, even if it means going against things that he previously held differently. That's what a populist does. A populist is a chameleon. They give the people what they want whenever they want it and make it sound like it's their own convictions. That's the problem with populism.
You know, years ago, when I lived in Michigan, there was a radio host who was, again, one of the many radio hosts, the liberal radio hosts that have brought out to attempt to blunt the influence of Rush Limbaugh, who we're talking about here. And his name was Jim Hightower. Some of you may remember him. He was a syndicated guy. He was on a number of stations. And he was accused of being a liberal, and he says, I'm not a liberal, I'm a populist. Well, there's an assumption into taking on that label of populism. And by the way, Jim Hightower was not a populist, because his position was not popular at the time. He was a liberal. And just like that, for instance, I think Donald Trump is a liberal. If you want to ask me why, for instance, I can dig up quotes from him where he says openly, I'm pro-choice. I'm not pro-life. And now all of a sudden he's pro-life. Well, that's a populist position, because everybody knows, as you pointed out, people are beginning to realize that an unborn baby is a human being, and therefore they're becoming pro-life. Well, you have to watch these people and listen to what they say, and sometimes you have to translate what they're saying. You have to translate what Donald Trump is saying. When, for instance, it's almost embarrassing when he gets asked a foreign policy question. because he's all over the board. He's saying whatever he thinks is going to get him more votes. So he's not consistent in his answers, and his answers are not deep by any stretch of the imagination. Now, I will be the first to tell you, if you want to ask me some really subtle questions on relationships with certain countries, I'm lost. And I'm not sure anybody can be a complete expert on everything in those areas, which is why presidents hire people who know what they're doing or purportedly know what they're doing in those areas to advise them. But populism and nationalism, and right now we've got both of those, as we've discussed, disguised as conservatism. Now, how can that happen? How can populism and nationalism disguise as conservatism? They can do it because those words really don't have any fixed definition. They are whatever someone wants them to be at that particular moment.
And that is exactly my concern with the idea of conservatism, because that word has become just that same way. It can be anything anybody wants it to be at that particular moment. So in other words, what Limbaugh is decrying and seeing is actually the fact that the veil has been lifted from the idea that we don't have fixed meanings anymore. And all you do at this point, then what you do is you get a nucleus of folks who share the same philosophy, whether it's nationalism or populism, or who that appeals to because they just don't know where they are, and they hear something they like, i.e. with Trump's rhetoric, and they flock to it, or they're disaffected by what they see as this is the representation of conservatism, and they see somebody else who's saying something that has more affinity to what they believe in the base of themselves. And I think that's what we're actually getting at, Chuck, or at least my analysis is, that what we're finding is people who don't have a fixed idea or fixed meanings, but have either emotional or traditionalistic sense of this is the way things ought to be, are flocking to somebody who's saying, well, this is the way things ought to be, whether that person really believes it or not.
Well, what you're describing then is that is a presuppositional schizophrenia.
Yeah, absolutely.
And okay, I'm supposing we better sort of dissect that a little bit, because people are going to go, what are those two boys talking about? Okay, presuppositions are the basic ideas that operate in your head that are the filters through which you interpret what you see, hear, feel, touch, taste, smell. There are a basic set of assumptions that everyone has, and I've heard people say presuppositionalism is a false concept. No, it's not. Everybody's got a set of filters that they filter things through. And the problem is, I will give you an example. Rush Limbaugh right now is being hoisted by his own petard on this conservatism thing. Because in the past, going back as far as the beginning of his program, he was willing to call George H.W. Bush a conservative. He has been willing to allow people to take the mantle of conservative who shared nothing like the values of people who were constitutionalists. And in fact, he has attacked people who were constitutionalists, like, for instance, Ron Paul, who would be the epitome of what I would call a conservative, because he wants to force the government to adhere to the limits placed on it in the Constitution. So Limbaugh is basically showing that he has been kind of the culprit in allowing these terms to float. So his presupposition is that as long as there are certain core values, and his core values are vastly different than, say, yours and mine would be.
Right.
As long as they meet certain core values, then they're conservative. Well, it's turning out that some of these core values aren't very conservative at all. They're simply big government, quote unquote, big government conservatism, which is, if you ask me, that's an oxymoron. And that's why we're having these discussions now, because we have been operating on these non-definitions, these floating, these wide, these soft definitions for decades. And it's now coming back to haunt us because nobody knows what the words really mean.
And I think we see that on the campaign trail, not just with Donald Trump. But I want to segue here just slightly over to, again, our favorite whipping boy, John Kasich, who just recently, Chuck, on a radio interview with Hugh Hewitt, basically stated this. And I just want to bring this up. This is coming out of an article from Breitbart by Charlie Spearing on Wednesday. And basically, the quote is, quote, and this is coming from John Kasich. He says, look, we have a lot of candidates who are like the Prince of Darkness. I consider myself the Prince of Light and Hope, and I don't spend all my time getting people riled up about how bad everything is. Now, Charles, if we don't if we don't have any fixed meanings for anything anymore, I wonder what John Kasich means by Prince of Light and Hope.
Well, I'm going to be the first. I will come right out and say that it's not shocking that Hugh Hewitt basically gave him the microphone and then stepped back and didn't say anything when this came out, because Hugh Hewitt showed what he was all about when he was one of the moderators on, I think, a CNN debate.
Yes.
He basically showed what he was all about. And Hugh Hewitt has been purporting himself to be a conservative for decades, and he isn't. This is the man who came out when Arnold Schwarzenegger took over as governor of California and said, you're going to love, he told a conservative audience, you're going to love Arnold Schwarzenegger as governor of California. And I'm telling you, I'm still waiting for that love to happen.
And he's not been governor now for a number of years.
That's right. But when you look at this, basically Hewitt is allowing Kasich to basically attempt to redefine the words Prince of Light and Hope, really. Is, yes. Can this man's ego get any more inflated?
I want to kind of step back here a little bit. Let's take a look at the history, because, you know, I think it wasn't so much that little quote about Prince of Light and Hope, but if you think about that, he's comparing that or contrasting that with the Prince of Darkness. Now, we all know who the Prince of Darkness is, right?
That's right.
We're talking about Satan. So, is John Kasich inadvertently in a messianic mode when he calls himself the Prince of Light and Hope in contrast to the Prince of Darkness? I'm really concerned, given some of the other comments and quotes that Kasich has made throughout the last, year, of chiding people who don't agree with radically expanding Medicaid and putting the taxpayers of Ohio on the hook for tens of billions of dollars of funding that will very shortly start being taken away by the federal government and having to be replaced by those state taxpayers directly instead of indirectly through the federal taxes. Of basically chiding people that, you know, when you get to the pearly gates, you're going to have to explain yourself, and telling people that he'd send them copies of the Bible so they could read where he's right.
Yes.
There are just these things about the man and about what he's saying publicly that is great cause for concern, especially this last part of that comment, that he doesn't spend all his time getting people riled up about how bad everything is, except that he calls people who have concerns about his embrace and forcing of Common Core education standards in Ohio kooks and fringe. That he calls people who doesn't agree with them, that they don't have any, that he has the right to define what words mean, what the, you know, conservatism means, that those people who stand for, you know, Republicans standing on the Republican Party platform, you know, are just out of touch because, well, who bothers to stand on a platform? His party doesn't. His chairman of the Ohio Republican Party has specifically said that the reason why they don't want to adopt the Republican platform is they don't want to be held to it.
Yeah, exactly. Well,
a direct quote. They don't want to be held to it. And so, you know, this whole thing, though, so now Kasich's now reinventing himself, Chuck, because now he's coming out, you know, his PAC, the affiliated PAC for John Kasich called New Day for America, spent hundreds of thousands of dollars on ads directly attacking Donald Trump. Now, I don't have any problem with somebody attacking Donald Trump and spending money to do so. If you want to, that's fine, because, again, he's doing the populist thing and he's not really conservative. But when you're coming from John Kasich, and these attacks were, well, vicious and nasty, but then you turn around and call yourself the Prince of Light and Hope, does John Kasich suffer from dissociative disorder? That's my question now, Chuck. Does he really completely believe that he is out there just being Mr. Positive and Mr. Hope and Mr. Light? And I guess Light and Hope is better than Hope and Change, I guess. What he's trying to
say. Well, okay, a couple of things on this. First of all, I'm not a psychiatrist and I don't play one on TV, and I'm not a psychologist and I don't play one on TV. But you raised the specter of messianic complex. Oh, yeah, he's got it bad. Now, let me give you an analysis of what I see happening in the future. John Kasich has gone to all this problem, and this plays off what you said. He's gone to all this effort to expand Medicaid. And once he gets into the seat at the federal government level, we all know it's all his whole argument is based on federal funding. We're going to get more federal money. We all know that when he gets in the big seat, the first thing he's going to do is, quote unquote, cut the budget. And the way he's going to cut the budget is turn all those Medicaid expenses back over to the states. At that point, he will no longer care about Ohio. He will care about his, quote unquote, legacy. And his image when he leaves office. He's the man who made the federal government work by cutting the budget, and we'll probably get more fake stories about how he balanced the budget. That's what he's been running on, and it's fake. The balance the budget was not balanced in the mid 90s, and John Kasich did not do it. And what little he did, toward doing that, he did by exchanging a vote on a gun ban for a vote on his laughably bad budget package. Yeah,
that's right. Well, Chuck, you know, all these things in the past are really indicators of where he might be in the future. But I think the biggest indicator right now, and for what people can look at, is the fact that here's John Kasich, who says that he has the right to define what conservatism means in Ohio as governor. He did say that. We've talked about that on this program before. And here's really, we now know by looking at what he's doing in New Hampshire, what he means by conservatism. And another thing, you know, this idea of no fixed meanings, here it is. So basically, in an article in Politico, of all places, that was put out on Wednesday, there's a snippet of, John Kasich on the campaign trail at a VFW hall in a senior center with people talking about global warming, income inequality, and raising the minimum wage, investing in renewable energy, saving Social Security. And this was not the Democrats. This was John Kasich, who actually, his strategy looks to be that he's going after independent and Democrat voters to come over and vote in the Republican primary for him. Now, he's been, you know, his campaign, and I still get the emails from them, are boasting of how, you know, Kasich's, you know, on the rise, and he's now, you know, sitting in second place behind Donald Trump in New Hampshire. Well, that may be a bit of whistling past the graveyard for John Kasich, because just on Wednesday, a poll from CNN and WMUR, which is a New Hampshire station up there, was released. It was conducted by the University of New Hampshire Survey Center. Where's John Kasich? Is he sitting in second place in that poll, Chuck?
Not even close.
No. Tied for fifth place in New Hampshire. So this whole surge is much like John Kasich's conservatism. It's based on empty words and unfulfilled promises. And so here's, you know, Kasich's out there actually trying to, I think what he's really trying to do is he's trying to limp his way to March 15th and supposedly win Ohio, so that then he can become part of a brokering scenario at the Republican National Convention, which is going to be held in Cleveland. Yeah. And so to use Ohio and his ability to win Ohio in order to find his place on the ticket as a VP candidate. Now, I don't know if the Prince of Light and Hope and the Prince of Darkness can work in the same Oval Office. Do you?
No, I don't think so.
You know, and so it's interesting in this Politico article by Eli Stuckles. I hope I pronounced that name right. I guess he won't tell me if I didn't.
Yeah, he's not listening.
He says something I think really interesting here in this down toward the middle of the article. And he was talking about, you know, this whole idea about Cruz, you know, working through the South Carolina and other places. And that really John Kasich's entire campaign is really McCain 2.0. John Weaver, who was McCain's chief strategist, is now John Kasich's chief strategist. And that's how really McCain ended up becoming the nominee, was he came out and won New Hampshire when nobody expected him to, and then worked his way through to the nomination. And so Stuckles says, okay, about Cruz, he says that's why Cruz sees Kasich, because of this whole tied into the McCain history, that because, of course, McCain died in South Carolina, he got beaten handily, but he still ended up limping into getting the nomination in 2008. He says, that's why Cruz sees Kasich as little more than a potential spoiler, someone who could help him by tripping up Marco Rubio by finishing ahead of the Florida senator in New Hampshire, but isn't likely to be a lasting threat. Kasich, who is polling at just 3% nationally, could well turn out to be the one living in an alternate political universe, ignoring the realities of a conservative base agitating for pretty much the opposite of what he's running on.
Okay, just for fun, though, an article again came out in Daily Caller. Bernie Sanders campaign manager Jeff Weaver says, if you want a Democratic candidate whose vision is limited to what the candidate thinks that the current Republican Congress will accept, you should vote for John Kasich.
Yeah. Well, and that's just showing you that everybody understands that Kasich is not a conservative. Kasich is just running. Kasich is a Kasich. He's running to better himself. And if he has to say whatever he feels like saying in order to do that, you know, he's doing this radical maverick independent streak, a la John McCain. And we saw how well that worked out for the country as Barack Obama ascended to the presidency of the United States because of John McCain.
Okay, just for fun. If you recall, what was the big deal about John McCain's campaign? What did he call his bus?
The Straight Talk Express.
The Straight Talk Express, yes.
That's right. I
have an acquaintance who I was renting a room from at the time for my business. Came up to me one day. This was in, I think was in 2000. Before, you know, McCain really came to the forefront. It was either 2000 or 2004. And he says, I want to urge you to vote for John McCain for president in the primary. And I said, okay, I want to know why. Well, you know, he's going to do this and that and another thing. I said, okay, so you're going to vote for him. Oh, I don't vote. I said, you don't vote, but you want me to go vote for John McCain. I said, first of all, let me tell you right up front, I wouldn't vote for John McCain for county commissioner. This is not going to be happening. And second of all, it strikes me as odd that you want me to go cast your vote for you. Go cast your own vote. This is the kind of thing that's very frustrating. People that want me to do certain things and will manipulate me to try to get me to do certain things. It's always fun when one of the political pollsters calls up here and it's a push poll. And Barry, one of the most fun things I get to do in life is to twist these push pollers in knots, because they'll start asking me questions. And I said, oh, okay. So I give him completely contradictory answers. Well, how can that be? They'll ask me, how can that be? And I'm like, well, how can it be that you're telling me that this person does this and this and this and this when I know better? Oh, but. We've come to a place in society where you can get away with that kind of thing because people are so incapable of critical thought.
Right.
It is a sad commentary that so little critical thought goes into anything.
You're absolutely right, Chuck. And honestly, I think that kind of brings us into another aspect here. And again, we're going to stick with the Republican contenders, but I think that one of the contenders, you know, John Kasich really believes that he's actually going to go and win New Hampshire and do all these things based upon the power of his positive personality. I'm not sure that I buy that.
Yeah,
I actually think maybe that latest poll might be more telling than what he's telling. But there are, you know, and as we're looking, New Hampshire is not the only place where there is a battle brewing for the Republican nomination, because obviously the first in the nations with the New Hampshire primary also is partnered with the Iowa caucuses. And Iowa is always a big, big stomping grounds for Republicans this time of year. And one Republican candidate in particular who doesn't get an awful lot of love from the media, as a matter of fact, he got so little love in the last debate that he was relegated to the second stage debate with Carly Fiorina, Mike Huckabee, and Rick Santorum, and said that he chose not to participate, and so he stayed out of the debate, and actually I think his poll numbers went up. And that was Kentucky U.S. Senator Rand Paul, who just recently, we're taping this on Thursday, and this was on Wednesday, had an interesting conversation on CNN's The Lead program, where he was talking with Jake Tapper and made some interesting points, that you and I wanted to touch on, and one in particular that we just thought was absolutely hilarious.
Joining me now to talk about the state of the Republican race, Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky. Senator, thanks for being here. Appreciate it. Sarah Palin endorsed you when you ran for Senate in Kentucky. It gave you something of a boost. When I asked her about which candidate she liked a few weeks ago, she praised Trump, she praised Cruz, she also praised you. You must be a little disappointed.
Well, I think that, we'd love to have her endorsement. But I think really the question still isn't her endorsement. The question is, Donald Trump a conservative? And I've often said that I think he is a fake conservative because, you know, the Tea Party movement got started because we were upset with bailing out the big banks. Donald Trump favored that. The Tea Party also got started because we were upset with Obamacare and a single payer where the government's in charge of health care. Trump supported that. So I think really that he isn't a conservative, and the endorsement may help people to think he is, but I don't really think he is a conservative.
You're certainly not the first person to make that charge. Why do you think it hasn't stuck? Because there obviously is something of a paper trail of his giving money to Democratic politicians, saying nice things about Secretary of State Clinton.
Right.
How come nothing sticks to him?
There could be this small thing that if you add up all of the time that he's gotten on TV compared to all the rest of the candidates, he's gotten 25 times more than all the rest of the candidates combined. So it's a question, did the polling come and so the news covered him, or did the news coverage cause the polling, which the chicken, the egg kind of thing? The other question is the polling really accurate? We think that it's wildly inaccurate and that you may be surprised on February 1st.
Governor Branstad in Iowa says that Ted Cruz has the best ground game in Iowa. You say you're going to surprise us all the night of the Iowa caucuses by a stronger showing than anticipated. What do you have in Iowa going that Governor Branstad doesn't see?
We have 1,000 precinct chairs. There are 1,600 precincts in Iowa. We have 1,000 precinct chairs. That's not a small feat to get 1,000 people that are your leader in the precinct, will help get turnout, and actually will speak for your candidacy on that night. I was just there this weekend. If you go into our headquarters, you'll see 100 young men and women making phone calls. They made 500,000 phone calls trying to find who our voters are and to try to turn them out. This is an operation that at least rivals Cruz's operation, probably exceeds Trump operation, and really exceeds probably everybody else in the field. So there are two or three people that have an operation to turn out voters in Iowa, and we're one of them, and we think it's unheralded.
Do you think that Trump is stealing the traditional Rand Paul and Ron Paul voters, that is, people who are anti-establishment, mistrustful of government, angry. I mean, is Trump gobbled them all up?
Maybe some of them. But one of the interesting things is the Des Moines Register did a poll recently. And in that poll, they said, how many of you are going to vote for Rand Paul? And it was about 5%. How many of you voted for Ron Paul? Wasn't much different. However, he got over 20% in the election. So we think that the pollsters aren't finding, my dad's voters aren't finding our voters. Many of our voters are young. They have cell phones. They don't show up in surveys. And many of our people just, I think, are outside the normal traditional Republican voter. They're people who have voted and will turn out, but aren't on the traditional lists of people that pollsters are calling.
All right, I have to ask you about this. You have said you'll support the Republican nominee, whoever it is, even if it's Donald Trump. Today, you wrote a Facebook post in which you likened Donald Trump to Gollum, the bad guy from Lord of the Rings. There's Gollum. There's a picture of the handsome fella. Okay, how on earth, or I guess I should probably say how on Middle Earth, is Donald Trump like Gollum?
Well, you know, Gollum was after his precious, his little ring, the ring of power. And to him, power was really important to be an obsession. And I think Donald Trump in some ways represents that in the sense that he's so smart, he's so rich. If you just give him power, he's going to fix everything. But, you know, I come from a tradition, the limited government tradition. Really, we hearken back even to the plains of Runnymede, to the barons challenging the king. We believe in limitation of power. And we believe that power corrupts and that absolute power corrupts absolutely. So we don't want a strong leader. In fact, I tell people all the time, I want to give power back to the states and the people. I want the presidency to have power taken away from it because I think the presidency's gotten too powerful. I don't hear that from Donald Trump. For what I hear from Donald Trump is he's so smart, he's so rich, give him power and he'll fix everything. But that concerns some of us who are students of history who believe too much power is the problem.
You'll concede that he's better looking than Gollum, though. That you'll think
no
about.
Fit was not a physical comparison.
Not a physical comparison. Senator Rand Paul, thank you so much. As I say to every candidate, good luck in Iowa. I hope it's a.
I really think it's very interesting to think about comparing Donald Trump to Gollum. but he is right, you know, and that is probably a bad tendency, even among conservatives, is, and John Kasich just exemplifies it by saying it outright, of having this messiah complex that if we just pick the right guy in office who's telling us the right things and we give him the power of the office, all of a sudden everybody's lives are better.
Okay.
And all of a sudden all of our problems are solved. All of a sudden everything is the days of bread and bread and circuses, probably. Yeah, wine and roses is what I was saying.
But bread and circuses is not a bad analogy either.
And it's not far off from probably what it would
no,
really
it's
be.
Not. And you brought up a point that that came to mind earlier, and I was going to make it, and I didn't find my opening. So here I now have my opening. The fact is that the reason that people get so angry is that they instill too much confidence in these guys to do exactly what they want them to do. In other words, they take them on as and I'll give Kasich credit for recognizing this, as a sort of a personal messiah, a personal political messiah. He's going to do exactly what I want him to do. This is why when I see people on social media in the conservative sites who are all rah, 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 Trump, 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 2016, Trump, 2016, they are setting themselves up for a gigantic fall. Because if this man happens to get the nomination, it's very conceivable that he could be elected, and he is not going to be what they thought he was. As these guys very often, I know lots and lots and lots of people who voted for Barack Obama for some of the dumbest reasons you've ever heard. It was time to elect a black man president. Well, we could have come up with a conservative, quote unquote, conservative alternative to this. You voted for him because it was time for a black man to be president. Did you pay any attention at all to anything that he did while in his very short time in the Senate? No, I really didn't know much about his record at all. I mean, Barry, how many times did for instance, Alan Keyes run as a Republican?
More than I can complete the count of, yes.
Now, we could probably say that he destroyed his credibility inside the Republican Party by vying for the Constitution Party candidate for president. Could we not say that he basically self-immolated on that, and basically he did not get the nomination at the Constitution Party. I had other people who voted for him because he was going to bring in universal health care, and now when they've seen what it actually costs and how the program actually works, they can't wait to get rid of Barack Obama in hopes that this thing will be quote-unquote fixed. This is the kind of thing that people think they buy thinking they're getting one thing. You know, you buy a sports car thinking you've actually bought a sports car, and what it turns out to be is it has an engine of a sedan in it. And it doesn't go very fast. It looks really pretty, and it doesn't go very fast, and it doesn't perform very well. It doesn't have good braking. The air conditioner breaks down all the time. The engine has to go back in the shop for all kinds of weird things. This is what we're setting ourselves up for because we expect too much from candidates.
Mm-hmm. That's true. And honestly, you know, you and I have said this before. What we end up having, and I heard this because I was at a meeting about a week or so ago that was based around one of the candidates. And I heard the person who was talking get up and say those famous words that we've heard every cycle, Chuck. Again, you know the words I'm talking about.
I know the ones.
This is the most important election in our lifetime. And we've got to get this one right. We've got to have the right guy. And I'm thinking to myself, no, what we need to have is the right 40 or 50 guys and gals sitting in the U.S. Congress blocking the administration and overturning Supreme Court rulings by actually taking up their constitutional mantle and voting responsibly and pushing laws that work within the Constitution. That's what we need. And honestly, until the conservative movement especially gets off this idea that it's all about picking one guy and winning the governing lottery, which is actually probably harder to hit than Powerball, we're not going to have any systemic changes or getting us back to constitutional governance or to conservatism. I'll just put it that way, in its classical definition. We're just not going to get there. And Chuck, I think a part of that is too is not only that, you know, simplistic desire to have the quick fix. You know, if we just pick the right one guy, then everything's going to be happy. But it's also, and I think Paul mentioned this one in his interview with Tapper, you know, he talked about history. You know, and I think that people don't understand history. They don't understand. Okay, we know from, and we're going to talk about this one here in just a second. We know that even people who have college degrees and education don't understand our government or aren't paying any attention to it. Let's put it that way.
Yes.
Is there any more you want to talk about this Rand Paul interview? Because again, there's a lot to unpack.
There's a lot of stuff to unpack. One thing I will say just real quick is that, there's a companion saying that goes along with that thing that you brought up. This is the most important election of our lifetime. The companion saying is what the GOPE says. You know, we played dirty pool on your candidate, and yes, we got our guy in. But if you vote for him this time, we swear we'll give you what you want on the next election.
Well, that's the Charlie Brown syndrome, Chuck, right there. That is, here's Lucy with the football saying, come on, Chuck, kick the football. No, Lucy, every time I've kicked the football, went to go do that before you pulled it away from me and I've ended up laying splat on the ground. Oh, no, I promise it'll be different this time. I swear to you, Chuck.
Yeah, exactly.
Please just come and kick the football. No, Lucy, I can't do it. Chuck, please look at me. I'm serious. I've changed. Okay. Wah! Splat.
Yeah, arg.
She pulled the football away again, just like she was planning to do all along.
Charlie Brown, arg.
Arg. That's right. Well, Chuck, here's a real big arg, and honestly, it's an arg in a different light. There was a poll that was just recently taken, and it made some headlines here. This poll was conducted by the American Council of Trustees and Alumni in August of this last year, but it was just now released this month. They surveyed 1,000 college graduates. 1,000, Chuck. That's a decent representative sample. I mean, you know that Ohio State University has, 57,000 people who come through the doors which means
they graduate about 13 or 15,000 every quarter. Every year.
So this is a small but statistically significant sample of college graduates. And the council put in their analysis of this that, quote, college graduates are alarmingly ignorant of America's history and heritage. And Chuck, probably the most egregious one, the one that's making most headlines, and this is from an article in CNN Politics by Daniela Diaz, is that nearly 10% of those college graduates believe that Judge Judy is on the Supreme Court. Now, Chuck, you and I were talking with Mike O'Reilly on our monthly call-in, and we got talking about that, and you reminded us of the older program before Judge Judy, which was the People's Court with Judge Wapner. And I think I mentioned that I think I would rather have Judge Judy or Judge Wapner as Supreme Court judges than I would Sonia Sotomayor, Elena Kagan, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, yeah. David Souter, Anthony Kennedy. I mean, the list could go on, John Roberts. I think we'd have better jurisprudence and probably more focus on their legitimate roles with two people who honestly really do this for a living.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, this is kind of stunning, but it's not stunning, Barry. People are so reliant on media to get the information, and they're also lazy. In other words, people are passive about thinking about these things. They'll just simply open up their brain, bring the stuff in, and say, oh, that must be the case. And you can see this playing out in things like this. If you've been paying any attention to the hype around the Making of a Murderer, this documentary.
Sure.
One thing, my daughter's been watching it, and her boyfriend's been watching it. And it's interesting to see their reactions. They tell me I ought to watch it, and I've watched some of them. And every time I watch it, it's painful for me because I can see that the filmmaker has an agenda. And that agenda, basically, they're trying to show that this guy, they have taken sides in this case. And from what I can see, their argument is that the police department and the prosecutor are corrupt, and they planted all this evidence on this guy. Well, look, you've now created a gigantic conspiracy.
Yes.
Now, if you want to, here's my argument all along. The guy's probably guilty, and the police and prosecutors are corrupt. Both. But we're set up. People don't like, they like false dichotomies. They don't want to think about both those things. It's either black or white. And in this case, it isn't. It's gray. And this is what you have to do. You have to be able to get in and say, okay, there's gray here. Let's see what we can do to shed light on the gray. And people don't want to do that because it requires work. You have to sit around. You actually have to sit down and think. And people are not trained to think anymore. And when they have to, they don't like it. It's painful. They'd rather be doing something else, like listening to music or watching a movie or something. Unfortunately, we live in a society where we get to pick our leadership. And because we don't like to think, we operate on sound bites. And sound bites is no way to make decisions on major policy issues. It requires thought. Well, guess what, Barry? We're out of time for this week.
That's okay. I just want to say for those who are listening, we do teach an Institute on the Constitution course where we can teach you who is actually on the Supreme Court and who actually is the father of the Constitution, and how impeachments are handled, and how amendments are dealt with in the Constitution. And if you're a college graduate, according to this poll, you might need that refresher course. So contact us at principledpolicy.com and let us know if you'd like to host an IOTC in your community.
And that's it for today. You now know what we think. We want to know what you think. www.principledpolicy.com. That's principledpolicy.com. And join us again next week for another Principles and Policies.